This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote our entire show to a special interview with human rights attorney Michael Tigar.
He came out of California in the early 60s, and he's never stopped. This is a great interview.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. As we enter the new decade, we look back at where we began, legally speaking, and where we're headed. 2020 began with President Donald Trump illegally and recklessly ordering the assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, who was on a peace mission in Iraq at the time he was killed by a U.S. drone. Although assassination had been secretly used by the U.S. government since the formation of the CIA in 1947, Trump's predecessor Barack Obama began the illegal, extrajudicial open assassination of people in what was called targeted killings. This even included American citizens. With regard to deportations, the Obama administration set a record by deporting more than 3 million people. Trump has continued massive deportations, but has also illegally frustrated and prevented people fleeing political repression from seeking asylum in America, separating children from families and caging them in a process that continues even now. The authorization for the use of military force was voted on shortly after 9/11 to justify the bombing and invasion of Afghanistan. The AUMF has since been used illegally to justify the presence of American troops in the Middle East. It was recently renewed. The Patriot Act has also been renewed, allowing for massive U.S. government surveillance of American citizens in the illegal derogation of their Fourth Amendment right to privacy. Truth-telling whistleblower Australian journalist Julian Assange, in the most important First Amendment civil liberties case, faces extradition from London to Virginia. The issue is his right to be a journalist and our right to know. If convicted, he will go to prison for life, destroying investigative journalism in areas the government deems, quote, national security. The people's constitutional right to impeach a president is also in jeopardy. The Democratic Party's attempt to remove Donald Trump from office is sure to fail because of Trump and the Republicans' refusal to honor the Constitution and to allow for a fair trial in the Senate. Trump has appointed hundreds of reactionary judges to the federal trial and appellate benches. A woman's right to control her own body, decided in the landmark case Roe v. Wade, will be decided by the Supreme Court, whose ranks have been bolstered by two additional reactionary judges, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. The separation of church and state and the separation of powers are also in jeopardy. We're delighted to welcome back human rights attorney Michael Tigar. He is a veteran of 1960s activism and has appeared many times before the U.S. Supreme Court, taught law at three schools, and has written numerous books, including the now classic Law and the Rise of Capitalism, and most recently, Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power. Michael Tigar, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's good to see you again.
Michael, you're from California. You grew up there and you went to law school out there. Chesa Boudin just got elected to the office of district attorney in San Francisco. He's now the main prosecutor and leads an office of 300 people. When he was sworn in 2 weeks ago, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor spoke at the ceremony via a pre-taped video. We've got a transcript of that video, and I'd like it if Heidi could read what Justice Sotomayor had to say.
Chesa, my court sessions resume next week, so I'm unable to join your inauguration ceremony. I sent you this message to tell you how much I admire you and to wish you well in your new endeavors. A little over 10 years ago, I was visiting the public housing project where I grew up in the Bronx. A film crew was following me around. As I left the building in which I'd lived, I stood next to a young child, about 10 years old, whose mother was looking down from one of the apartments above us. The child asked me why all the people surrounding us were making such a fuss about me. And I paused to think and finally said, I grew up in this building where you live now, and there are many people who think that kids like us can never become something important in life. They think because we may be poor in money, we are poor in spirit too. You're not, and I'm not that way. We can make something of ourselves, and my becoming the first Latina justice of the United States Supreme Court is proof that people like us have a chance in life. Well, Chesa, you too are an example that gives hope to so many. It is uncommon for a former public defender to become a district attorney of a major city like San Francisco, especially a district attorney who spent his childhood visiting parents incarcerated for committing serious felonies. As you described it to me, the difficulties you faced as a child, including that you did not read until age 9, are common among children of prisoners. You have lived the stigma of anger, shame, and guilt that so many such children in the criminal justice system experience. By your own admission, you were fortunate that friends of your parents had the means to help you get back on track. But your parents' friends could not supply you with the strength of character and moral composure that ultimately led you to graduate from Yale College with high honors, become a Rhodes Scholar, clerk for 2 respected federal judges, be awarded a Lyman Fellowship, and publish scholarly and important social justice pieces. Your personal strength and commitment to reforming and improving the criminal justice system is a testament to the person you are and the role model you will continue to be for so many.
Michael Tiger, what were your thoughts when you heard Sotomayor's talk?
Well, I went to school at Berkeley, and I went to law school there. My son was a public defender in San Francisco County. So my first thought was, oh, my God, thank God. Goodness, the district attorney's office in San Francisco is going to get honest again. This is the district attorney's office that spent an untold amount of money prosecuting Lenny Bruce for saying one word, the word that would colloquially describe Oedipus. We all know that all politics really are local, and district attorneys have enormous power. They have a power to determine the scope of prosecutorial discretion, where you will and will not prosecute, who you will and will not prosecute. They have the authority to say to the police officers, are you sure you got it right? Aren't you hiding that evidence? They have the authority to go into court and say, listen, Your Honor, we're kicking this prosecution because we found out that the police committed an illegal seizure, and we're not wasting the county's money trying to litigate this issue. Let's have a do-over. So that's the first thing that I thought about, is that here's a job that somebody can do. In the tradition, as you pointed out, of Terrence Hallinan, who I knew as K.O. Hallinan, one of Vince and Vivian Hallinan's 6 sons, all of whom became in their own ways famous. Con Hallinan is still down at Santa Cruz. Pat Hallinan was a well-known trial lawyer in San Francisco. And K.O. Shook the place up, and now Chesa is going to do that. It's pretty funny because as a kid, you know, I didn't know the district attorneys did that. My image of a district attorney was in the old Mae West movie when Lloyd Nolan was the corrupt district attorney, and he says to her, what? Have you ever heard my ethics questioned? And she says, honey, I've never even heard them mentioned. This could be a good new day.
Michael, what challenges does Chesa face? He's vowed to roll back mass incarceration, to prosecute police misconduct, as you suggested, to be for restorative justice, and to set up diversion programs. He said that 80% of his clients when he was a public defender were either mentally ill or had substance abuse problems or both.
He's going to face some opposition from the police department and from the old-line district attorney establishment. K.O. Hallinan, Terrence Hallinan, faced that too and yet got reelected. So I don't think that's insurmountable. As a district attorney, he really does have the power to go into court and say, no, no cash bail, Your Honor, which, as we know, if you get arrested and you got to post cash bail and you can't, you're going to lose your job because you're not going to show up for work. And all that does is set the whole process back and end the possibility for reintegrating somebody into society or even for meaningful review of the facts on which they were arrested because they'll be in jail before they go to trial. So he's seen the system. He's not somebody that dropped in from the sky. Anybody who's ever been, as he has been, a public defender in San Francisco County, as was my son, knows exactly what's going on.
Is the police union in the Bay Area as zealous as the one we have here in New York City, for example?
Well, I don't know that there's a meter by which you can judge zealotry. These reactionary forces poured not only a lot of money into the campaign opposing Chesa, and then just before the election pulled that switcheroo by appointing the acting district attorney as district attorney so that maybe she could get some more votes and so on. So they did every dishonorable thing that was possible to head this off. So I don't think they got a good grade on their report card.
Yeah, they put in $650,000 just in the last week alone against Chesa, and he pulled it out. It was really quite extraordinary that he built a team that went door to door, particularly in the Chinese areas, and he got their votes, and he squeaked it out. Michael Tiger, you had previously mentioned a progressive district attorney in San Francisco named Kay O'Hallinan, and he held the office for 5 years. His father, Vincent Hallinan, was a leftist attorney who actually went to prison, like Chesa's parents. Hallinan went to prison for defending the radical union leader Harry Bridges, the longshoreman. That was a real thrilling ride with Kay O'Hallinan. Talk about those days, because they may anticipate what we're going to see with Chesa.
I showed up in Berkeley in 1958 from Glendale, California. We had lived with my grandmother when I was in elementary school, who took us every week to the Lake Street Baptist Church. Glendale was a segregated community. And I walked onto the Berkeley campus, and I thought, oh, my goodness, am I going to fit in here? And my roommate said, well, there's a local radio station. It's by something called Pacifica, and you can go down there. And I went down, and I volunteered at the radio station. I tried to volunteer, and so they let me. And I met the people at Pacifica Radio. That's the first thing. People who had worked in the BBC in the Second World War. Fred Haynes, who later wrote the screenplay for Ulysses. John Leonard, who later was cultural editor to the New York Times. I'm a 17-year-old kid, and I learned from these people. And the second thing I did was go to a class with Professor Jacobus ten Broek, who was blind, who wrote many books, including an expose of the Japanese internment. And that freshman class opened my eyes. Later on, I had a journalism class from Pete Steffens, Lincoln Steffens' son, who, as a matter of fact, invited me and my wife over to meet Harry Bridges and his wife, and so on. The Longshore Union facing automation in the San Francisco dock was a big issue. The Committee on Un-American Activities came to town, and hundreds of people were arrested protesting them. This was Berkeley, as they say, quote, in the 60s, quote unquote. But I had come to Berkeley as an NROTC regular midshipman. That is to say, the Navy was paying books, tuition, and living expenses. And so I get to Berkeley, and suddenly the idea that in my first year I'm studying the power of the Navy to keep our little brown brothers in subjection. And it seemed to me, you know, I'm not sure that this is why I joined up. And then in my second year, we were to do a paper on naval weapons. So I did one on nuclear disarmament. And the commander called me in and said, I'm giving this back to you. It's not going in your file. This could harm your career to be talking about stuff like this. The captain at one point took me aside after he'd showed the troops a film strip called Communism on the Map, which identified the Longshore Union as a communist front and all the rest. And he said, well, Midshipman Tiger, what did you think of the film? And I said, well, sir, I thought was mostly half-truths. He said, well, what was the rest of it? I said, well, the rest of it was lies, sir. And 8 weeks later, they kicked me out of the Navy. And anyway, that's a longer story that I tell in a memoir. But the point was that there was this mind-opening process that happened. I mean, I come from a family. My father had 8 grades of school. He was a union officer. He died when I was quite young. We never talked about that time a whole lot. But it was interesting because it brings back what a crucial difference that I try to make in this latest book, Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power, a shameless commerce plug. And that is that there's a lot of ideology being tossed around here, racist ideology and this and that and the other thing. But the way Chaser got elected and the way that we're going to change this world is door to door, person by person, and so on. So if you're listening to my voice and you say, gee, what can I do? The answer is you can do something every day. You can call up your member of Congress. You can go door to door or whatever. Sorry, end of speech, but this was a great time in my life.
Michael, we'd like to have your appreciation of the rapidly accelerating destruction of democracy and the rule of law here in our country. This has been, as you know, the underlying theme of our radio show for the past nearly 16 years. And there's no one better to talk about this than you, of course. It didn't start with Trump, but he and the insurgent Republicans, whom we've characterized as neo-fascists, are doing really horrible things to our institutions and practices. We'd like to talk about Trump pardoning the murderous Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher. Trump even fired the Secretary of the Navy who got in his way. What are your thoughts about this?
The unbridled exercise of irresponsible executive power was precisely the thing that those who wrote the Constitution feared most. Patrick Henry made a speech. And what if your chief executive comes to the Supreme Court at the head of his army? What then? Well, and for that reason, he thought there were insufficient protections. That has been a debate in our country from the very first moments. From the moments when, well, not too long after we started, Thomas Jefferson tried to try his opponents by military tribunals, the associates of Aaron Burr, and was frustrated in doing so by John Marshall, himself no raging liberal. I wrote about this. You can Google my name or at Monthly Review. I wrote an article about this a few years ago about this process and the role of the courts. But okay, let's talk about Mr. Trump. The job of the commander-in-chief of the Army is to enforce the laws of war. When the commander-in-chief sets an example for the troops that says that troops are free to violate the laws of war by committing crimes against humanity, then that's really the beginning of the end. And that begins to replicate the experience we saw in Nazi Germany. Make no mistake, saying grace over war crimes is itself a crime against humanity. It was Admiral Keitel saying grace over the mistreatment of Russian prisoners of war in violation of the conventions that led the Nuremberg Tribunal to vote for a death sentence in his case because they thought it was so serious. So right now, yes, we all need to stand up and say something about this because it isn't simply that the bad acts are done, but that that not enough judges are standing up and saying, hey, excuse me, Article 3, independent judiciary, this can't happen.
The Navy SEAL, Eddie Gallagher, who Trump helped, killed a young man who was laying there on the ground. Gallagher took out his own personal pocket knife and stabbed him in the neck, murdering him. Previously, he had shot a teenage girl, killed her. His actions were so egregious that his own troops turned him in. He was tried and acquitted, except he was found guilty for posing with the dead soldier he had killed as kind of a victory photograph, and he was convicted of that. And then the right-wing forces inside of the military and outside of the military pressured Trump, and Trump, in turn, to curry favor with these forces, did what they asked him to do. He refused to punish Gallagher. The Secretary of the Navy didn't like that, so he got rid of the Secretary of the Navy. That's what we're talking about here, isn't it?
Well, it is. And again, if there are people in uniform within the sound of our voices, the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the field manuals require you, when you see conduct that violates the laws of war and violates the prohibitions against war crimes, to take the matter up through the chain of command and to blow the whistle. I've given talks to military people, particularly those involved in getting ready to do defense in Guantanamo, and from time to time soldiers and sailors and so on will come up to me and say, gee, thank you, because there are a number of us in the military services today who are doing our job and attempting to report on instances like this.
Michael, what about extrajudicial murder, what the Obama administration started calling it targeted killings? Was the assassination of General Soleimani illegal?
Of course it was. It was illegal in a number of things. Let's start back with the drone program itself. Again, the Monthly Review article deals with some of this because maybe 30% of the people killed by these drone strikes are, by anybody's account, civilians. There's thousands of people killed who ought not to have been killed under anybody's theory of the world. And the second thing is, then we killed Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen, and his family sued and was told that, well, it's not justiciable. The courts won't get involved in it because it would involve the revelation of secrets and so forth and so on. Coming back to this whole idea of the government imposing the bar of secrecy to prevent us from knowing what's going on in the world. So we start with the idea that what's happening with drone strikes is unlawful. And then we move on to the fact that assassinating high government officials as an instrument of national policy, yes, is itself a war crime and a crime against the peace.
And without involving Congress.
Even if Congress approved the assassination of a foreign leader, you couldn't do it. It wouldn't be right. But yes, the absence of congressional debate is one thing that contributes to this sort of thing. We're not the first people to say this. In 1833, Joseph Story, the second most famous justice of the Supreme Court of the 19th century, wrote commentaries on the Constitution talking about the dire national calamities that would follow on the unrestrained exercise of the war power.
Michael Ratner and I wrote a book several years ago on how and why the CIA assassinated Che Guevara. And in the course of our research, we learned that the CIA had been assassinating people pretty much since its beginning in 1947. But the difference then was they did it secretly. And the head of the CIA was interviewed about this, and he said, we wouldn't want to consult with the president because we wouldn't want to embarrass him. But now we have a president bragging about it.
We have a president who's beyond embarrassment in so many areas of his conduct.
Michael, what about the situation with secrecy and the attack on journalists?
This is unprecedented in our world. Not exactly, not completely, because it began, the current spate of these things, during the Obama administration. Let's be clear. I mean, a little history. In 1971, some of us at this table remember that Daniel Ellsberg turned over 47 volumes, the Pentagon Papers, to the New York Times and the Washington Post, all top secret. And the government tried to prevent publication. Irwin Griswold, who was Solicitor General of the United States, former Dean of Harvard Law, had to argue that in the Supreme Court of the United States. And so he had the 47 volumes delivered to his office in the Justice Department, and he brought experts from defense and state, and he started reading. In the 47 volumes, he found 11 individual instances of items that he thought could be arguably called secret that he could defend in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. All the rest of it, he thought, were things that people were entitled to know about how the Americans were misled about the war in Vietnam. And so, of course, they lost in the Supreme Court. But three of the justices mentioned in their opinions, gee, maybe the Espionage Act. Who knows? Who knows? Well, now we see. And in 1977, just after Jimmy Carter became president, John Mage and I represented David Truong, the young Vietnamese charged with espionage out there in the Eastern District of Virginia. And what we found out was that the release of these State Department cables, which a former National Security Council person said really didn't have any bad effect on America, David got convicted. And at that time, the New York Times reporter told us that the Justice Department had considered prosecuting the Times, but decided that as a matter of policy, they weren't going to do it right then. But another thing we found out was we told the judge, I said, Your Honor, this cable traffic is all stamped secret, and the jurors are going to think, oh, gee, it's terrible, but it was misclassified, and it shouldn't have been secret. And the judge said, no judicial review of that. The jurors will see this, and you can't argue otherwise. 2010. Congress passes the Overclassification Act of 2010 and makes findings, and you can read the findings, that it's pandemic throughout government, classifying everything that people are entitled to know. Of course, the statute, despite those findings, simply asked each agency, why don't you look it over and see if you could do better? And then they put the Department of Homeland Security in charge of ongoing review, which, do you raise chickens? Put the fox in charge of the hen house. So the statute didn't do much for us. So that's just the beginning. And I could add, by the way, the Espionage Act was never intended to apply to journalists. The legislative history.
And how often has it even been used in the last several decades?
Oh, in the last 12 years. If you internet search Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and Columbia Journalism Review, and you will find reports of the dozens of instances in which the use of the Espionage Act has occurred or been threatened. A month ago, a government lawyer stood up in a journalism prosecution in Washington, D.C., and said, from the standpoint of this administration, leakers are worse than spies. That is the harbinger of things to come.
With regard to asylum seekers, Michael Tiger, what is Trump and Stephen Miller, who's in charge of harassing immigrants in the White House, what have they done to frustrate and deny the legal right of refugees to seek asylum in our country?
Well, first of all, those of us in the room with gray hair should remember that we faced this problem with respect to the Salvadorian refugees a couple of decades ago and the prosecutions of nuns and priests and so on for offering a shelter. On the border today, it's exponentially greater. The backlog of cases, even where you can make an application for asylum, separating parents and children at the border, holding people under conditions that are really concentration camp conditions, and, as a matter of law, violating domestic and international law that governs or should govern the processing of asylum applications, denying that right. That's been enjoined twice. There have been two injunctions entered, both of them by my son, United States District Judge John Tiger. And I've read his opinions, and it's not my place to judge. The interesting thing is that after he wrote those opinions, the first of those, Trump denounced him as an Obama judge, and Chief Justice Roberts came to his defense. I'd like to call attention to the fact that John's nomination was voted out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously by all Democrats and all Republicans, and that he was confirmed by a unanimous Senate on a voice vote. So for whatever that's worth. But in these times, as in other perilous times, Article III judges represent one of our most important hopes. As I pointed out, John Marshall standing in Thomas Jefferson's way about the Aaron Burr case, and then Jefferson's own appointee to the court, Justice Johnson, overruling one of Jefferson's opinions about so-called protecting our borders. You can look it up. Those are nice stories, and we hope to hear them
Article
again.
Article 3 justice, to remind our listeners, is a person that gets appointed for life.
Yes.
They've got that protection.
Yes, they do.
That being said, I thought it was extremely courageous for Justice Sotomayor to send that message to Chesa Boudin.
Well, it was. You know, you go and argue before the Supreme Court of the United States. It's a magnificent, august institution. And the great justices in our history are those who don't forget that they once started out as lawyers, who sit there and ask questions and want to hear what the lawyers have to say because the lawyers know the case and know the circumstances of the people who bring the case. There are justices who had no such patience. Scalia probably the worst in this century if to have to confront. But that is a real mark of a jurist who's worthy of the name, what Justice Sotomayor did.
Scalia, I imagine you appeared before him, would just make fun of you, right?
I did appear before him, and his questioning style was to ask abrasive questions that weren't really questions designed to take up your time and then sort of poo-poo your answer. Justice White did that also from time to time. Do you have 2 minutes today? I was arguing Gentile versus the State Bar of Nevada about the First Amendment rights of lawyers. And it's in and Justice White was giving me a hard time. Justice O'Connor had been very nice. And so in rebuttal argument, I cite a case, and White suddenly starts to yell, "Mr. Tiger, has this court ever held?" And he raised up his hand, and my daughter was sitting in the first row, and this little voice pipes up and says, "Mommy, why is that man yelling at Daddy?" Wait, we won 5-4.
Michael, the impeachment process, it's limping along. The Republicans in the Senate have really tried to wreck the chances for a full and fair trial. And for their part, the House Democrats have limited the impeachment inquiry to the narrow question of Trump's actions with respect to the Ukraine, ignoring everything else illegal that he has done. What are your thoughts about that?
At this point, the prospect of getting impeachment in the Senate is pretty slim. We all know what that's going on. I fault the House Democrats for, first, having turned the investigation essentially over to people from the intelligence community who can tell us this, who can tell us that, and because they're pumping up the credibility of the intelligence community, which I think is always a bad idea because it comes around and bites you later on. And second, there has been a diversion by virtue of all of this from some of the issues that the House majority really ought to be focusing on right now. Here are millions of Americans toiling away at wages that don't permit them to support their families. Here are millions of Americans attempting to organize into labor unions, such as the Service Employees Union, for whom I've worked and so on, people in underpaid marginal jobs, victims of outsourcing, who really need the support of additional legislation to make the union representation process better and more accessible to people. There's a whole list of things to do. And if you have the power sitting in the Congress of the United States, as some of the younger members of Congress have said, that would be a more productive way to use your time. That said, of course, Trump is dishonorable. He doesn't care about the process.
I just want to add, I saw in the Times today that raising the minimum wage by $1 was found to decrease the suicide rate by up to 6% among adults in the 18 to 64 with a high school education range.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, I don't know how all of us grew up or all of the people that are listening. I'll tell you how I grew up. I grew up and worked ever since I was 14 because you had to. You could if you had that was when you get your work permit. I had a paper route before that. Let me tell my dad. My dad had 8 grades of school. He left home at 14 right after his own father had committed suicide on one Sunday morning. And he worked his way across the United States. He worked as a ranch hand in Wyoming and so on. That's how he met my mother, was he used to give horseback riding lessons in Griffith Park later on to meet girls. And he gets to California, and in 1930s, everybody knows there's a war going on. And so the aircraft factories are tooling up. Douglas Aircraft in Santa Monica, Lockheed in Burbank, Consolidated in San Diego, Boeing in Seattle. My father gets a job at Lockheed. Now, at that time, unions are trying to bust into those workforces, and the L.A. police are hiring out to be goon squads to goon the union. And in 1937, though, the Wagner Act is passed, and Lockheed decides, well, tell you what, we'll recognize a union, but we won't recognize a CIO because they're kind of leftist, you know. We'll recognize the International Association of Machinists, which is an old-time craft union. And my dad became executive secretary of Local 727 of the Machinists, the largest machinist local in the United States. Well, war starts, and all of a sudden, African Americans are entering the workforce. And the machinist union called my dad and said, well, look, Charles Tiger, whites only. And my dad, even though he had 8 grades of school, had a magnificent vocabulary. He didn't use the F word, but all the other words that you could possibly use to describe things. And I'm not sure what he said because he hardly ever talked about this with me. But I've looked back at the records. He told him to go to hell. And it was the only machinist local in the United States that defied the national and admitted African Americans as full members of the union through the war. So, that's how I grew up.
Trump has appointed many unqualified people to the judiciary, stacking the federal court system for years to come. I know you've thought a lot about this. Share those thoughts with us, would you please, Michael Tiger?
These appointees are being selected for ideological reasons. You've seen some of the confirmation hearings in which people have no experience or knowledge, whatever. The one from Louisiana whose nomination finally was withdrawn because under questioning by a Louisiana senator, it turns out he really didn't know anything. This is terrible, of course, in the appellate courts, in the Supreme Court, with those sorts of appointments where ideology could be said to make a difference. But where it really hurts, that hasn't been talked about as much is in the federal district courts. In the federal district courts, a lot of those cases are just people that have been denied their Social Security benefits. The question is how long will a sentence will they receive? They want a jury trial that's fair. They want the case to move. And here are judges being appointed who have no idea of how to run a courtroom where people can be heard fairly and their cases decided in some orderly way. He is staffing the bench with these utter incompetence. And so that, in addition to the ideological thing, I've talked to a couple of Court of Appeals judges, whose names, of course, I won't mention, who say, you know, I talked to a very conservative Court of Appeals judge, Alito. He says, you know, he said, more and more, he said, just by circumstance, I'm being pushed into the far left of our court when I was appointed by Ronald Reagan to begin with, you know. So
yeah, I know. People are having that view of Judge Roberts now on the Supreme Court. It's really extraordinary.
Michael, you've written a wonderful book, Law and the Rise of Capitalism. Capitalism is no longer the robust engine of change that it was in the beginning. What happened to the promises made by the Bill of Rights 200 years ago? Monopoly and finance capitalism have concentrated wealth in such a way that a billionaire is created every 2 days in this country. This has clearly twisted representative democracy. Please talk about the implications of the Citizens United case and its ruling that corporations are people with the rights of free speech and that money is speech. How do you relate the destruction of the rule of law and democracy to the change we see in modern capitalism?
My writing career is bookended by Law and the Rise of Capitalism, which has been translated into a number of other languages, and most recently by Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power. I wrote Law and the Rise, sat down in 1969 to write it because after the events of 68 all over the world, it seemed to me that I needed to think about the role of law and the possibilities and limits on the possibilities for social change if I was going to be a lawyer. Maybe I should go do something else. But the key to this fact is that you can say capitalism is an engine of social change, yes, but that book documents at what price. The promise of freedom that the capitalist system made was always illusory. Because what it said was that the institution of property is purely a neutral institution, that is, the relationship between a person and a thing. Well, what if property that you own happens to be the means of production and the other people in your community don't own means of production? Gee, that means that some will work for others and that those who own the means will get the profit. The last chapter deals with that in a more theoretical sense. So we ought to have seen Citizens United coming. Even as great a justice as Justice Brennan was captivated by the idea that money could be speech, that the idea that the First Amendment somehow protected you if you entered the marketplace of ideas with the money to buy instruments of communication. That was, and I thought that was wrong. I thought that was an illusion. But it is in the nature of money. Money is the universal commodity, right? That has been ever since the late, you know, Sophocles' late plays. We don't need to go into that, but great Marxist writers like George Thompson have written about that. So in a sense, the result should not have surprised us. What we hoped was that the countervailing values about citizens' participation would militate against such a result. But that's always been the contradiction of capitalism. Was that the engine of change, as you put it, is the private ownership of the means of production with all that entails. Everything else, like the promises of liberty and equality and so on, well, they're promises the regime makes, and the process by which they are not enforced is relatively fragile because much of that enforcing is turned over, guess what, to judges. Trump understands that very well, as Michael's question a few minutes ago illustrates. So what we need to do here is to take back the discourse. A little while ago, you said you knock on doors, you go house to house, you got Chesa Boudin elected. The fact that we don't own newspapers and television stations doesn't mean we can't knock on the doors of people who do are watching television or reading the newspapers. We need to take politics back to the people. Everybody within the sound of my voice can do something every day about the situation we face.
Let's turn the dial back for a moment, Michael Tiger, and talk about your experiences and what formed you as a human rights attorney. Let's go back to your growing up in California in the 50s and the 60s. What was it about your experiences then that caused you to become a human rights attorney?
My mother was working for Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Permanente, when it first began in California as the health plan that union members would get in the steel industry. And the big medicine opposed that. So we had that at home, right? My grandmother was somewhat conservative. We lived with her because my parents were divorced, but my father had worked for the union. And, you know, we grew up under circumstances in which you could see how people lived. And it was Glendale, California was a segregated community, but my mother made sure that we associated with all manner of folks and all conditions of folks. And then I can remember when I was 11 or 12, I was visiting my father, and I said, you know, I think I might want to be a lawyer. And he went into his bedroom, and he brought back Irving Stone's biography of Clarence Darrow. And he said, well, read this. He was a lawyer. He was for the people. You want to be a lawyer, you be that. And I said, well, okay, and I got to Berkeley. And here, as I say, I was the possibility opened. And I spent my undergraduate years trying to figure out, should I be a history professor? Maybe I could write a book about something. Should I be a journalist? Because Pacifica was really going great. Or, mind you, I'm in college 58 through 62. I'm in college 58 through 62, and, you know, the Supreme Court is deciding these cases, some right, some wrong, and I see it's the lawyers, but not just the lawyers because they can, but it is the lawyers who are seeking to understand the human condition in ways that all the political scientists and sociologists were somehow not doing, and really get a seat at the show. You have to run for office to get it. You just have to be chosen by somebody. And for me, that was an opportunity. You know, KPFA and the people around it was under attack for its free speech policies. And so there were lawyers helping us out, just as Al Bendick, who had been Lenny Bruce's lawyers. I absorbed all of that and decided, well, this is what I would like to do. And then I get to Washington, and I'm in a law firm, Edward Bennett Williams Law Firm. That's doing that stuff on wiretapping and gosh, isn't that? And somebody in our neighborhood says, would you represent a guy who was charged with threatening his girlfriend with a knife and his lawyer's lousy because he didn't do it and the police officer misunderstood? And so I went down to the court, and I never represented anybody before. But I thought, well, I learned how to do that. I watched. I could do that. And I got a not guilty. And we see Michael's laughing now over there. It's the same thing happened to my son his first week in the public defender's office. He called up and said, Dad, I got a not guilty. Well, that takes care of that, right? That's like your first drink. You need to go back.
Yeah, I was remembering the first criminal law case that I got. It's a scary proposition, isn't it?
It is.
Have that responsibility on your shoulders.
We caught the cop lying. I mean, that probably doesn't happen very much, but I mean, we caught him.
Let's go back to law school. Michael Ratner's autobiography, which is about to come out, he talks about his days at Columbia Law School. And he said all he ever did was study. And it resulted in a success, but it was a grueling experience. What was your experience in law school?
I was told that it was no use for a lefty to go to law school unless he was first in the class. And so I said, well, how do you do that? He said, well, just study more than everybody else. So I did. And for a while, I got sick from it, but I rebounded. But in addition to just studying, remember, this is 63. I raised my hand and I in contracts class, and I said, excuse me, professor, if I have a lunch counter and I put up a sign that says hamburgers, 10 cents, isn't that an offer? And somebody else comes in and sits down and says, I'll have one of those hamburgers. Isn't that acceptance? So am I contractually entitled to have a hamburger? And he said, no, that's not the way it works. I said, I know that's not the way it works, but you're teaching us the law. You know why is contract law not being brought to bear? And he said, well, that's just not what it is. And I said, well, that can't be. So I went and found a case from Quebec in which a guy, a person of color, bought a theater ticket. And that because he accepted the offer to buy the ticket, and this Quebec court held that he was entitled to go see the show. And I brought it into class, and I translated it from the French, and everybody was laughing and so on. So, yeah. And then in the property course, I said, well, you know, look, the restaurant owner, if there's a fire in his restaurant, what does he do? Get his mother to put it out? No, he calls the fire department. Property is invested with a public interest, no matter whose property it is. Well, they didn't want to listen too much to that. But the point was you had to keep challenging. I mean, we had a criminal law professor named Rex Collings, who was a big fat guy and so on. He hated what the Supreme Court was doing. I'm going to teach you criminal procedure, he said. It's about the spreading buttocks of due process. And which is how you characterize the court's opinions. So I posted a poem on the wall. Under the spreading buttocks see the state policeman stand, his blunted anti-crime implement shriveled in his hand. It was quickly found out who posted the poem. There's parts of it that goes on to say that we can't say on the radio. And so I thought that was important as a law student to try at all times to remember why I was there.
You eventually left the Williams Law Firm and you set out in private practice on your own. And in previous discussions, I've heard you talk about how that's a good thing to do and you can do it. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. I was a partner. I came back to the States after writing Law and the Rise of Capitalism and was at Williams & Connolly, Edward Bennett Williams Law Firm. And after 3 years, my friend Sam Buffone and I started a law firm. And among our cases, we were working on the Letelier case, the assassination. We were working on the David Truong case. And when I say you can do it, I meant this. We started a law firm saying we're going to do a third of our time pro bono. Well, let's look today at the barriers to entry of starting a law firm. We had to buy a Lanier word processing system that cost $25,000. And it had the computing capacity that you could get for $6.95 at Best Buy. 695, that is. We had to have space for books that we had to rent, you know, per square foot, whereas today online libraries are there. That is to say the barriers to market entry, if you want to start your own law firm, are lower today by a factor of 1,000 than they were when we started out 40 years ago. And this is important because I've met young lawyers that have done this. When we had a house in Southport, kid across the street, he said, well, I think I'll just hang out my shingle. So then he started going to the Moose Club and the Elks Club and meeting people and shaking their hands. Why? Not because their politics were like his, but because they used to get drunk on Friday and get DUIs. Or they had teenage kids that got busted for marijuana or whatever. And then they started coming to him. And I thought, this replicates. At Williams & Connolly, one of the first movement cases I ever did while I was there was Ed came in my office one day and said, the daughter of one of our major clients has just gotten arrested at Columbia. I told him we had somebody on the premises who probably could handle that. So So there I was. I come up to New York, and you started out. Then we went to 100 Center Street, right, yeah. With the judge, with a big plastic bag over the American flag, and one of the letters was missing behind him. It said, "In God We Rust," and but I was a lawyer that could do that.
Michael, talk about please the importance of law clinics and how they can contribute.
Law clinics represent the first opportunity that many of these students will have to meet people who are marginalized, demonized, all aside, whose life experiences they don't know anything about, and to listen and to try to, well, of course, we lawyers don't provide solutions. We just provide outcomes. So we're conscious then of the limits on our ability. I'm really proud of the Washington College of Law Clinic, and I'll tell you very briefly in the time we have. Jane and I, my wife and I, had represented the lawyers who represented Texas in the tobacco case, and Governor George Bush tried to take away their fee, not give them a fee for this, even though they won $17.5 billion. So after a couple of years of successfully battling on that, they offered us a bonus. They said, we'd like to give you $2 million. And we said, no, we don't want the $2 million. Why don't you give it to Washington College of Law, and we'll found a human rights clinic and use that to pay the expenses of this clinic, because we believe that students are capable of being engaged in human rights litigation. And so it is. And I'll give you two examples. First, the International Court of Justice just decided the Chagos Islands case. You can look it up. Our students worked on the briefing in that case all the way through all the courts, the United Kingdom, European Convention on Human Rights, ICJ. And then in Chile, Michael Townley, who killed Orlando Lietio and Ronnie Moffat, also assassinated a Spanish diplomat, Carmelo Soria, in Santiago in 73. And his widow wants to get him extradited to Chile to stand trial. So we worked with Spanish and Chilean lawyers. And I went down and I actually argued in the Chilean Supreme Court with my limited Spanish for a couple of minutes. And the justice said, no, we cannot do anything in this case because Townley got amnesty from Pinochet for murder. And so my students went down and said, yeah, but there's a separate offense under the Chilean penal code called illicit association, which means if you commit your crime in company with others, then and that's not in the amnesty. So we went back. And the unanimous Chilean Supreme Court held that the entire Pinochet secret police apparatus is an illicit association, and they interposed an extradition demand with the United States. The Trump administration is maybe not going to do anything about it. But these are students, and they are gaining experience in what folks can do in order to battle the injustices that are in this world. And that's important. But even in the clinical programs, I say that have to do with landlord and tenant. The problem is that students are filled with these grand ideas about justice. And as I point out in my memoir, Sensing Injustice or Fighting Injustice, being able to sense injustice, this manageable notion, here's an injustice I can do something about, is so much more useful to the world than trying to imagine great ideas about injustice. Gore Vidal wrote me a letter about my memoir and said, you know, that's it. You got to keep focused on that. So everybody that's listening, hey, don't mourn, organize. Every day of your life, do something. Hey, what? Call your congressman today and say, hey, by the way, person will answer. Would you ask the congressman, please, does he like the health care plan that he has? And when he says yes, tell him, gee, I'd like one like that too. And when can I expect to have it?
Ted Kennedy was honorable in this respect. He wouldn't take the health care plan on the basis that no one else out there in the general public had it, and why should he have it? Michael Tiger, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, sadly enough. But before we leave, we've got a couple of minutes.
You mean my allotted time on this interview, right?
Right.
Not on this earth, Michael.
Thank you.
Heidi and I would like to ask you your final thoughts for us today.
Well, I think I've already done it. That is to say, if everybody that's listening would say, what can I do today? An opportunity to confront, to deal with, to say something about injustice will arise. 3 weeks ago, my wife, Jane, was standing in the line at the supermarket in Oriental, North Carolina, when someone made a derogatory remark about the African-American clerk. And so Jane tapped her on the shoulder and said, excuse me, ma'am, I just wanted to tell you that I don't think that's right what you did. That's not okay with me. So why don't you say something different? The opportunity will arise. You'll find it, because we are going to change this world.
Michael, you are an inspiration to all of us in the studio and all the progressive lawyers that I know.
Michael Tiger, just one last thing. How can people follow your work?
Thanks to the internet. Well, if you work for the National Security Agency, you don't really have a problem because you will. That's the last government agency that listens to us. But if you put my name in a search engine, T-I-G-A-R, you will see the Mythologies book. Put it at monthlyreview.org. I've written a lot of articles over the last several years about the issues we've been talking about.
Great. Thank you so much. Michael, for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.